Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for more traditional exercise such as weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447. Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, December 10th, 2014, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and I'm joined today by Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Ernest Perry and Catherine Reed. We've got a lot planned for the next half hour, including talking about massive changes at the New Republic, some changes at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, different ways that comments are going to be restricted a bit on its opinion content, and we'll talk about how the media coverage looked after a New York grand jury decided not to indict a Staten Island police officer who put a deadly chokehold on Eric Garner. But my guess is we're going to spend a good chunk of our time today talking about the Rolling Stone story about sexual assault at the University of Virginia. Friday, the magazine's managing editor issued an apology saying it had reason to believe there were problems with the account that Jackie, the unidentified victim in this case, had given of her attack at the Phi Kappa Psi House. We're lucky to have Catherine Reed sitting in with us today for Mike McKean because she brings a unique perspective to this conversation, having done extensive reporting on sexual assault herself and teaching our class in trauma journalism. Catherine, thanks for being here with us this week to talk about this. I know you have strong feelings about what's happened over the course of the past 10 days or so. What have some of those initial reactions been?
Well, my first reaction to this story was that I thought, wow, just, you know, as many people did, I'm sure. It was so explosive. But the details about what was going on at UVA as a on campus, as a university, were familiar to me and seemed similar to other accounts, including reporting that we've done here at Missouri. About the process, the student disciplinary process, and the very few students who tend to access it, and the lack of transparency in the process. The account of Jackie in the story was also, it was just unmistakably riveting. Mm-hmm. And the style of the writing really drew me in. And I think a lot of people were drawn in by that story. And so I had my students read it as an example of, you know, a particular kind of reporting, and then almost immediately started reading the other media accounts, sort of analysis of that story, that were finding weaknesses in it and flaws. And it started out with being primarily a discussion of the fact that the reporter, Sabrina Rubin Erdely, had not contacted the accused men in this particular case that she used as sort of the centerpiece of her story. And my first reaction to that was, if readers thought and media analysts thought that that was going to resolve the question of whether or not this thing occurred as she described it, well, they were going to be deeply dissatisfied by that because, yes, we need to talk to the people who are accused of very serious crimes. But it was the way that argument was being made, I thought, reflected a certain lack of understanding of the way sexual assaults have to be reported. And then there was further unraveling of certain details. So my first response to it was as, you know, just really powerful journalism. And then I started to look at it more closely over the last few days as these revelations have come out about certain inconsistencies. And, of course, in the middle of this, Rolling Stone writes this note to its readers, which is a kind of apology, which they later revised.
Yeah, I'm going to want to talk about that, too, and mm-hmm. the idea that the initial apology talked about different ways that it was almost as if Jackie's story was unreliable in some way.
Well, the sentence was that they had.
Yeah,
that
I thought I had written it down. I don't have it in front of me.
That they had their faith in Jackie had been misplaced.
Yes, that's exactly the phrase
they have now deleted. And what I don't know, because Rolling Stone isn't being very transparent and hasn't been from the very beginning, as Ernest and I have already discussed about what inconsistencies it was referring to. We don't know whether or not they deleted that sentence because of the backlash to that sentence, which was, wow, Rolling Stone, nice job throwing a trauma survivor under the bus, whether that was the reason for it or if it doesn't accurately describe Rolling Stone's feelings towards this source. The first thing that should be said about this is that this is just a terrible thing for this woman, this person, this trauma survivor, and Rolling Stone has treated her really badly. And I think it reflects a lack of understanding on the part of the reporter about the neuroscience of trauma and how it affects recollection and how people remember things who have been victims of crime. There is no debate in Charlottesville, Virginia, among the people who know this person, that she was the victim of something terrible. Something awful happened to her that transformed her from a bubbly first semester freshman, excited about school, excited about being at UVA, into a person who, as her roommate has recounted in a letter that was in the Charlottesville newspaper or the student newspaper, yeah. I think it was, right, that she became this person who couldn't even be bothered to turn off her alarm in the morning, that she would pull her covers up over her head and stayed in bed for months, you know, and eventually did have to visit the dean of academic affairs, I believe it is, to explain why she was not passing her classes. So this is something transformational occurred in her life. My reaction now is just distress for this individual. And then all the other reactions, which have to do with, you know, on the one side, the damage that's been done to this discussion that had begun to become what it should be around the subject, the very important subject of campus sexual assault, that there's been damage done to that. But then there's the damage done to journalism and the damage done to survivors of sexual assault. And the woman out there who maybe last week was thinking, you know what, it's time I told somebody what happened to me, who will now not come forward, not only because of the way this situation has unraveled with the Rolling Stone story, but also because of the vigilanteism that has resulted, for example, with this conservative blogger who's decided to publish her name and is saying that if she doesn't, quote unquote, come clean about her past, he's going to tell the world.
There are other things that he's going to bring forward, too.
I think like Catherine said, we sort of talked about this when Rolling Stone started its
three paragraph apology.
I think what happened was that there was just so many inconsistencies that people were pointing out that Rolling Stone felt like they had to say something. And I believe in most cases like this, lawyers get involved, probably lawyers for the university, lawyers for the fraternity, maybe even lawyers for some of the men that were involved, all started jumping in and saying, well, wait a minute, what about this? What about this? What about this? And then you start seeing those inconsistencies. And I think a lot of it is just a lack of transparency on the part of Rolling Stone as to how did they go about vetting this story to begin with before the story ran in publication. I think that that's something that news organizations are going to have to do. I mean, how many times are we going to get burned before we decide, along with producing the story and putting it out there, we also have to talk about how we reported it at the same time so that the public itself will say, okay, you did do due diligence in putting this story together. I mean, you can go back to Dan Rather when the whole thing with Bush came out. You can go back to previous stories, even if you go start looking at some of the stories on Ferguson, mm-hmm. some of the stories on Trayvon Martin. Mm-hmm. You can go back over and over and over again about how we are not transparent and how we're doing our reporting. And then we want to become transparent after the damage has been done. And Catherine's right. I mean, there's been a lot of damage committed by Rolling Stone and other journalists having to do with this because that transparency wasn't there. I mean, I think it was Claire McCaskill yesterday in a Senate hearing, basically called out not just Rolling Stone, but journalism in general about what this has done to hurt the publicity and the work that she and others have been doing in trying to get sexual assault and the issue of sexual assault out there before the public.
Well, and as we're kind of beginning to wrap up 2014, this had been one of those areas where there had been a lot of growth and a lot of movement forward. A friend of mine who is a reporter who has covered sexual assault issues on Notre Dame's campus, among others, she came right out and said, this sets us back a decade, if not further. In that effort to do that and to report on these issues.
Well, I hope she's wrong.
Well, I think we all do.
Yeah, that, you know, I mean, not a decade. And certainly in Charlottesville, there seems to be evidence that their very overdue discussion of this problem is taking place. And it doesn't sound like they're going to back down very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with you on that in terms of the University of Virginia. They know they have a problem.
Right.
And they're not going to let what the backtracking that Rolling Stone has done force them into sort of quashing the steps that they've taken in the last 2 weeks in dealing with this.
The problem is that for people who tend to want to disbelieve or are skeptical of sexual assault reports just in general when they come out, and there are these people, believe me, when you read comments, and we're going to talk about comments a little later.
That.
Yeah, you know, that, and actually sexual assault stories are one. That's one of the kinds of stories where news organizations do often just shut down
when
comments.
When I worked at the Chicago Tribune, that was definitely one of those on the list that you automatically clicked no comments on. So that a board wasn't even opened or associated with it.
Yeah. So, but for people like that, you know, this just unfortunately validates because they're going to choose to believe certain. What I think they're going to come away with is, you know, well, there's some flaws in this story. The whole thing isn't true. Well, you know, I think that anybody who's paying close attention knows something terrible happened to this person. The other thing that's really strange about this story, and there are many strange things, but one that is unusual is that Rolling Stone didn't make contact with the alleged assailants because the survivor asked them to have no contact with them. And the fact that they weren't transparent about that fact in particular. So these are things that, you know, nobody knew when they read the story. I made some assumptions that made me initially very supportive of that story, which is that I assumed because Rolling Stone has fact checkers and that they claimed that their fact checkers had thoroughly checked out this story, that there were certain negotiations that had taken place between the magazine and the survivor, which, you know, often happens in cases like this because it's very difficult to get rape survivors to talk to the media for reasons that should now be very obvious to all of us. Mm-hmm. You know, I assumed that there was a certain kind of due diligence that had been done that not all of which was being shared with us out of respect for the trauma
but
survivor.
But that part of it should have been shared.
Yeah.
Should have been in the story.
I totally agree.
And the fact that it wasn't, and we found out after the fact, does damage to the credibility of Rolling Stone the next time it tries to do something like this.
Right. And for me, you know, my perception of Rolling Stone, which has done some terrific investigative
Crystal.
Yeah, great investigative reporting over the years, has fallen so far in my esteem. You know, we had a conversation in class about the story, and I said it's going to be a long time before I assign my reporting class to read another piece in Rolling Stone with the same sort
of— At least as a shining example.
Yeah, yeah. But you know, on the other hand, I'd have to say that as a cautionary tale, this is boy, really instructive.
So here's kind of a process question for you, Catherine, and Ernest, for you as well. One of the things that's been reported was as this story was getting ready to go to publication, as it was in the final stages of editing, that Jackie had come back and said that she wasn't comfortable with it anymore and didn't want to go forward.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you say, okay, and respect her space, or do you keep moving? And was that another problem we
have here? Oh, absolutely. Right then, you have a big problem. Your story is going to change because this person no longer wishes to be in it. One of the cardinal rules a reporting on trauma is that you really have to give a lot of control to the final of the final product. You have to negotiate some control of the final product with the survivor, right? And because of the emotional state of this person, I'm assuming what happened is she didn't like the shape it was taking, or she just lost her. I don't want to use the word nerve, but I sort of like got
kind of
cold.
Feared what would happen after the fact.
For reasons that we just don't know right now. For the journalist involved, Erdely, that's when she should have said, okay. And instead, what she did is she pushed forward with it. You know, that gets back to this problem and that I think occurs sometimes in our craft, which is that sometimes we want so badly to do a story. And I think in this case, Erdely wanted so badly for this story to be true as exactly as she was writing it, that she overlooked so many parts of the verification process that we would apply to just about anything else.
Yeah. And I think also part of the negotiation of the reporter and the source of the story is that they should be walked through the process.
Walked through the process, right, what this is going to be like. And, you know, you're going to get to see it. That's not an uncommon request.
No, that's something that's
trauma
done all the
survivors,
time,
right?
Is that they know what the story is going to look like as the story is unfolding.
Right, because the last thing you want to do is take that sense of control away from a sexual assault survivor.
And ultimately re-victimize them.
Right. I mean, and I have been thinking about this woman so much in the last few days, and my students have been saying the same thing, like really worrying, genuinely worrying about how she's doing, because I just, you know, I can't even imagine.
Well, I have to say, on some level, that gratifies me because that tells me we're training a next generation of journalists who are going to be sensitive to these issues when they go out in their reporting.
So.
Well, if you're looking for your December issue of the New Republic, keep looking. That's because the management there decided to cancel publication this month after a good number of the staff left in a mass exodus last week, protesting some changes that were being made at the top. On Thursday, the magazine's editor and longtime literary editor stepped down when news came out that ownership was looking to replace that editor, Franklin Foer. Then in a separate announcement, the magazine said it was going to be cutting back production from 20 issues a year to just 10. The idea behind it, the vision, is to reinvent the New Republic into a vertically integrated digital media company. Now, the New Republic isn't one of those mainstream publications that most people are relying on, but it has a very storied history. This is a bigger thing than it appears just on the surface.
Yeah, I mean, it's a long time inside the Beltway publication that people of a certain political or ideological mm-hmm. bent rely on. It's the liberal sort of think tank magazine that's been out there. And I think what was happening here is that you had the new owner who basically came in from Silicon Valley, from Facebook, mm-hmm. Who was thinking about or wanting to change the way and the direction in which this was going from a distribution standpoint. I'm not so sure right now whether or not he understood that when you do that, you're also have the problem of changing the content as well.
Yeah.
And I think that's where a lot of the conflict came into play.
Well, and a lot of the people who walked out the door, they were saying there are already enough sites like that, enough news organizations like Vox, like the Huffington Post, that what this was really going to do was just ruin the legacy of the New Republic.
I mean, I'm not sure about that because the legacy is changing as we speak. And you're seeing this in a lot of publications, both mainstream and even on some of the early online publications. Their formats and the way in which they go about doing their business is changing. So I think this
time being a perfect example.
Time is
of
a perfect
that.
Example. I mean, even if you go back and you look at Politico. Politico has changed over the course of the time that it's been out there. So I think that it was one of those things where you're having a major disruption of something that has been the way it's been for a long time, and there's conflict going on in there, and some of those people just decided, hey, enough is enough, and I don't want to go down this route.
Well, I think that there would have been an acceptance of change. It was such a radical departure from what the New Republic had always been doing, and I think that what makes matters worse is the suspicion that Chris Hughes, who bought it, just got mad. He didn't like the way his partner was treated by the East Coast media, maybe this is a billionaire's plaything kind of situation.
I mean, yeah, because you're not really making any money off of this, right. And I think he was wanting to break even. But to me, it goes back to what we were talking about in the last story, and that's transparency. Mm. There wasn't transparency within the organization about what was going to be happening and why it was going to be happening. There was very little conversation, very little communication.
And what was coming out through leaks.
Exactly.
Well, either he just outright lied or he changed his mind, because initially Hughes did say he was going to keep things pretty much the same. He wasn't going to mess with a good brand, more or less. And then he absolutely messed with a good brand.
Okay. Well, last week, just as we finished up recording our show, there was breaking news coming out of New York City that a grand jury there had decided not to indict a Staten Island police officer caught on tape restraining Eric Garner during an arrest. Video I'm guessing you have already seen many times on television news or online shows the officer with his arms around Garner's neck, taking him down to the ground in a chokehold while you can hear him saying he can't breathe. Since Wednesday's announcement, there have been peaceful protests for the most part all across the country, again with that theme that Black Lives Matter. Juxtapose the coverage that we saw in the Eric Garner case with the coverage that we saw 2 weeks ago coming out of Ferguson.
Well, I think if you look at that, I mean, like you say, there were peaceful protests. Mm-hmm. So the images are much different in this case as opposed to the other. I think the conversation is the same. And what tends mm-hmm. to... I think if you go to our links blog and you look and read Eric Diggins' piece from NPR, I think he really points out what the problem is, and that's the punditry has become a part of the news coverage. Hmm. And when you have that, you don't have a real conversation about what the issues are when it comes to race, when it comes to the Black community and policing, when it comes to how the media is covering it. All that gets lost when you have the pundits out there actually trying to cover the story while at the same time opining about it in the middle of all of this chaos that's going on. I mean, it creates this confusion on the part of the public. And then what the public does is everybody runs to their camps that they sort of believe in and trust, and you really don't have that conversation.
Well, yeah, it polarizes the debate. And the people who most of us would fall somewhere in the middle on most things, although I would say that in this recent Garner case, I think that what's been striking is that most people, this overwhelming opinion seems to be that this was absolutely excessive force. And
that video,
and the video
shows it.
Yeah, right. But I think the problem is with issues like this, and actually in the Rolling Stone and the UVA sexual assault case, is that people tend, once the conversation has gotten polarized, once the debate's gotten polarized, the people who want to have a really interesting, subtle conversation anywhere in the middle just feel drowned out by what's happening on the other ends. And you feel like you cannot find a reasonable discussion.
Right.
And there are so many reasonable discussions to be had out there. I think partly what contributes to this is the problem of people not wanting to read entire stories and really think through all the subtleties of anything anymore. So if it's not something that they can sum up in 140 characters, and some people are better than that, at that than others, mm-hmm. Then it just kind of gets lost.
But I also think part of the problem is that a majority of the public still gets a lot of their news from television.
Mm. Oh,
and the fact that you have people who are on pundit shows on one minute and then all of a sudden they're out at the scene trying to cover it, I think that's a huge problem, because they're out there also giving their opinions about what they're seeing, and they're talking about that other than talking about the issue itself and dealing with the facts on the ground and not their opinion of what the facts
right.
are.
Right.
So when we're talking a little bit about those folks who are getting drowned out in the conversation, those people in the middle, it kind of takes us into our next topic. A change at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, the paper is no longer going to allow comments on its editorials, columns, and letters to the editor. The reason behind it, the Post-Dispatch says, is specifically because of what people have been writing and what the comments have been like on its editorials and columns related specifically to Ferguson. Also trying to tamper something it's calling the nasty effect.
Yeah, I think what's happening here, and they're suspending it for 2 months, so it's going to be interesting to see if they're going to bring it back. But I think what's happening, and if you've gone and seen that, I mean, it's this polarizing thing that Catherine was just talking about. When you go to those comments, there's really no conversation. They were hoping that this would generate some conversation. There's no conversation. There's just hate. And there's hate on both sides. There's a lack of understanding or even a willingness to understand. And it's just one person after another just throwing out their comments. And it really doesn't contribute much to much.
And sometimes those comments are based in truth and sometimes they're not, which then we've also talked about this, the idea that it then creates extra work for journalists to go clear up those misconceptions and those mistruths that show up under their masthead because of the comments.
I mean, and what you're starting to see in some of these comments is you have the commenters yelling at each other. And it's not really about what the story is. It's about them trying to get their particular point across. And that doesn't engender any kind of meaningful conversation either.
Okay, so before we wrap up today, another thing to talk about with what's gone on in Ferguson. As much as it's still happening, it's already becoming a part of history. The museum in Washington, D.C. is collecting artifacts from reporters who covered the protests from August right up to this very minute. And it's all going to go into an exhibit called Make Some Noise, Students in the Civil Rights Movement that's set to open up next Friday. What do you guys think? Is it too soon?
As a historian, I don't think it's too soon to start grabbing that material.
Okay.
Actually, I'm pleased that they are. Because what tends to happen is that stuff gets lost. So the fact that they're actually out there on the ground.
Better they have a reporter's notebook than it show up in the bottom of somebody's drawer 5 years
from
now.
No, exactly. I mean, that they're collecting this information. I think that's good. What sort of bothers me, and I want to see how they do this, is the fact that they're going to start putting this on exhibit right away, like in December.
Next Friday.
And you know, it's that thing of, okay, what about the context of it? I mean, from a museum standpoint, that's one of the key things that museums and places that do this kind of history. This is the thing that makes them, I think, unique in the fact that time allows you to have some context and really understand what it was all about. It's kind of hard to do that when you're in the midst of it, especially if you're talking about a place like the museum, which deals with it from a news media standpoint. As we've just got to talking about, we're still trying to figure this out, and we're not doing a very good job of it right now because we're in the midst of it, and we have the pundits and the journalists and the freelancers and everybody else chiming in. How do you craft that into something that is going to be meaningful for someone who's walking through who has no idea what you're talking about? And there are a lot of international visitors who are coming in and looking at that going like, okay, how does this look compared to what I'm seeing in a newspaper on television?
Yeah, it'd be kind of hard to curate that right now.
Yeah.
It's like, how do you shape a narrative out of something that's still just really free-flowing. Right. It is good that they're asking journalists to sort of, you know, people who were there to, you know, hang on to this stuff. Because if you're really in the middle of covering a news story, it might not really occur to you that something would be significant and interesting later. Usually takes someone detached, you know, somebody, you know, one of Churchill's relatives to go, you know what, we shouldn't throw out this box of letters.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, maybe Churchill's not a great example, but
I mean, I think it's that detachment and that time span that's sort of missing here.
Okay. Well, we're just about out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about today. Check out our links blog. It's under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @views on KBIA. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, to leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to Pat Akers for handling the audio for us today, and to our team of associate producers, Kendrisa Cockrell and Hope Kerwin. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.